I don't know if anyone's tried Googling the term women's liberation lately, as I did in preparation for this talk. If you do, it may or may not surprise you to find that with one exception, all the references to women's liberation for page after page are either from the left or socialist side of politics, or they are historical references to the mighty women's liberation movement of the 60s and 70s, you know, part of the worldwide revolutionary upheavals of the time. Only socialists today talk about women's liberation. You can meet many variants of feminist analysis at uni or in the opinion pages of the newspapers, but liberation, freedom, real equality, a serious, full-scale end to the ways that women are oppressed is not part of the feminist agenda today, despite the fact that feminists claim the mantle of the women's liberation movement. It's not part of the mainstream, or even part of supposedly radical feminist positions. I think it's no coincidence, actually, that only socialists and revolutionaries want to talk about women's liberation in a present-day sense, because only socialists and revolutionaries actually oppose capitalism and fight for a world based on cooperation and sharing. And only socialists have a clear argument about the agent of this change, the working class, men and women, black and white, of every religion, sexuality, colour, culture and country, united and using our collective power to build a new kind of society free from oppression. Oppression I would define not as the dictionary does, as kind of like people being mean to each other, but rather as systematic inequality organised through or underpinned by social structures. Now, all class societies, including societies before capitalism, have oppressed women, but we haven't always lived in class societies, and it's capitalism that drives women's oppression today. And this oppression is centred on women's role in the family, specifically with regard to how the children of our society are raised and fed. So, how does the family work? How does it work to oppress women? Now, as you all know, under capitalism, if you don't work, you don't eat, leaving aside those who live off others' work. We also know that under any social system, if you've just had a baby, you don't work. So any society like Australia, where there is no system of universal paid maternity leave, oppresses women, simply, for the awesome power that we have of being able to create new life. Yet, from government, to church, to media, to advertising, women's role as mother is promoted as the most important, sacred, natural thing a woman can be. Declining birth rates are met not just with alarm, but with an ideological onslaught against selfish career women on a baby strike, and exhortations... I'm not making that up, that's a direct quote. And exhortations from government leaders to have one for mum, one for dad, and one for Australia. Now, if a woman is going to have children and not starve and there's no social support, then of course she's most likely going to have to be in a relationship and rely on that. And indeed, the special status of marriage, including de facto marriage, was affirmed only a few years ago by the Australian Parliament as only being possible and legal between a man and a woman for the purposes of procreation. You would think we were still living in the Dark Ages. Now, you might ask, why am I so sure that I can blame capitalism for this? After all, on the issue of maternity leave in particular, Australia is about the worst in the world. You know, there are countries throughout Africa and Asia with far less, you know, social structures than what Australia has that have comprehensive maternity leave for all women. You know, capitalist countries in the European Union that extend it to paternity leave, into childcare and early childhood education and so on. And yet, even in those countries, it is still overwhelmingly women who end up staying home with the kids. Well, why? I think one point that's missed sometimes is that work itself is oppression. Working class families, men, women and children, are oppressed by the capitalist exploitation of labour. That means we all work much harder and longer than is necessary for a decent standard of living. The workday is extended and, you know, multitude of useless jobs performed purely for the benefit of capitalists who use the extra hours in the working day and pocket the full value of them. Thus, no matter how good a maternity leave scheme might be in Cuba or Norway or wherever, and, you know, let's not forget that even the best of these fully funded schemes actually only extend for a few months. I'm not sure what, you know, the baby's supposed to do, go out and work a living by itself after that. You know, middle-class families will still be oppressed by the strain of full-time work. It's one of the reasons that even where childcare is relatively well available, most parents who have a choice don't send their kids to childcare full-time, because childcare, like the schools that follow them, is not set up to benefit children. It's set up to benefit parents' labour force exploitation. Children need far more individual attention than the capitalist system provides through school or childcare. Hence, where families feel they have a choice, they usually choose at least one parent to spend as much possible time with their kids to avoid babies being made to suffer full-time work. In fact, it is also the case everywhere that women's work is paid less than men's. And in Australia, the very latest figures show that women earn just about 84% of what men get. Now, often the same job is paid the same no matter who does it, but across industry, many jobs are dominated by males or females. And what we find is in the areas where women work, nursing, teaching, services, social work, retail, clerical, hospitality, these are paid much less than comparable work in male-dominated trades. Not only that, but women are more concentrated in casual and temporary positions, which reduces overall pay and entitles women to far less benefits in terms of leave, overtime and allowances. And you'll notice too that the jobs women do tend to mirror the ideological positioning of women via the family as nurturers, carers, servers, cleaners of mess, organisers and beautiful, smiling, helpful faces. So when a woman has kids, with a man, when that family considers who is going to stay home with the child for some or all of the time and who is going to go out and get work, then it is usually the man's job that pays more or that can't be done part-time. With very rare exceptions, childcare is not available in the workplace either, which would facilitate women being able to maintain breastfeeding while returning to work. Now, once this division between home and work has been established, the work of cleaning and maintaining the house and its inhabitants falls disproportionately on women. The 2006 Australian Census confirmed this, showing that women averagely do between 5 and 14 hours of housework a week, men do averagely less than 5, and a full third of women do more than 15 hours. Now, when you consider that 40% of Australian women were back at work either full-time or part-time before their youngest child had turned one, you can see how unequal these figures are. Now, extend this snapshot of how the family system works. Extend it over a few generations, let alone the dozens of generations, we've been living through. It's not hard to see how sex roles become hardened and stereotyped, how it starts to seem as though, the situation is actually reversed. Instead of social structures creating, women's and men's roles, it seems as though women's and men's roles create the social structures. And, of course, this perception is boosted and maintained by official ideology. And I think the pressure in families is exacerbated by the particular structure of the family under capitalism. The nuclear family of two parents and the kids, which despite, all the ahistorical crap that you see in movies about 10,000 BC or whatever, a family of two parents and the kids is an artificial construct which was virtually unknown before about 150 years ago. Just children need and yearn for far more stimulation and love and support than just two or one and a bit adults can give. Yet the straitjacket of working class life in the nuclear family isolates and individualises parents and their children. Parents today try to do the right thing by staying home with their kids, only to find that doing it alone, especially with more than one child, leads to women feeling desperate at having no time for yourself, overwhelmed, guilty for feeling angry or resentful towards the kids. You just think, currently there is no quicker way to financial desperation than trying to put a roof over your head at the moment than having kids. In a sane, socialist, human-focused society, proper housing would be a basic right, and without financial pressure, the effort of bringing up kids could be a community joy. While older kids, older people, as well as parents and neighbours and relatives sharing the care, while still all having the satisfaction of doing other work besides caring for little ones. If you are still in doubt that the capitalist system gets a massive benefit from women's oppression, Consider how capitalists themselves calculate it. The latest Australian figures, which are actually from 1997, assess the value of unpaid domestic labour, including childcare, as a staggering $261 billion annually. This figure is equivalent to 50% of Australia's GDP. GDP is the money value of all economic activity in a country. The capitalists want our children. They want more workers growing up to fill their offices and their mines and their warehouses. They want them to read and write. They want them to say please and thank you, to be fed and clothed and housed until they can start work on their own account. But no class society has ever justified its oppression on the basis of naked greed. There has always been an ideology, a set of ideas that seem to justify inequality based on the oppressed or exploited's supposedly natural inferiority. The double standards about men's and women's sexuality. You know, one is a stud, the other is a slut. The obsession, sometimes fatal, that women have with their appearance, their weight, their attractiveness. The distorted sexuality of men and low status of women that lead to rape and sexual violence. All these are based on a social system that forces women to depend on relationships for sustenance. The claims that women think differently, are too emotional, irrational, can't read maps, talk too much, that we are passive, naturally caring, uniquely suited by our biology to wipe asses and blow noses and read nursery rhymes, that men are from Mars and women are from Venus, you know. All these are based on a social system that depends on women holding families together and bringing up kids for nothing but love. This runs so deep that it is impossible to grow up without internalising society's ideas about women's place. You know, parents of young children often remark on how early the differentiation starts, you know, with young toddlers already showing preference for gendered activities, girls playing with dolls, boys with trucks. Are these gender differences innate? Some might be, for all we know, but whatever the differences there may be in the babies, we can say for sure that socialised gender roles are so ingrained, and largely unconsciously at that, in the adults that children relate to, that I don't think the questions about gendered brain structure can really be answered scientifically until several generations have grown up in a society without sexism. From the day we are born, women get the message that it's our job to look beautiful, to be helpful, to care for others, and to clean up mess. We'll also learn, not least from the examples we see in our own families, that we'll have to do all this on top of working and studying. We'll grow up seeing that the people at the top of our society, in government, in business, in sport, in music, as on our television screens as experts, are mainly men. We'll see countless cartoons where the heroes are men, or there's one token woman who, apart from her superpowers, has to be sexually hot. We'll see countless episodes of Neighbours, Big Brother, Australian Idol, etc., where women model such behaviour as focusing on relationships to the exclusion of other activities, getting in trouble for being sexually active, being judged according to their weight, clothing, hairstyles, or ability to get on with others before anything else. So just in the way that racism claims to be based on the fact that non-whites are fundamentally different, biologically less intelligent or whatever, so sexist ideas claim that women are naturally, inherently, you know, biologically suited to motherhood, being sex objects, caring for others and domestic drudgery, even while the facts of life point in the opposite direction. Around 60% of all Australian mothers work outside the home. Women make up more than half of students in higher education and so on. And when you look into this whole family racket, you can also see quite clearly that there's no payoff for working class men in this setup. Sure, it's unfair and unequal that women do a lot more housework than men. And, you know, we're against that in the here and now. You know, we are for men pulling their weight. We are not for you, you know, leaning on your partners or your mothers or whatever, you know, and not pulling your fair share around the house. But what you also tend to see is that working class men who are parents particularly end up working a lot more overtime, especially as financial pressures cut deeper and deeper into family life. Pressurised relationships with both parents are ground down by kids, work, making men's eat are awful for men too. To claim, as some feminists do, that working class men benefit from this harassed and stunted family life, as though working class men are forcing women to raise children and do the dishes as a personal service to them, is to completely miss the point of how oppression is structured by the relations of production under capitalism. Now, establishing that women's oppression is part of capitalism is paradoxically a positive step. The reason why is that capitalism can be defeated. Women's liberation is not only necessary, it's possible. This is where Marxism decisively departs from the feminist critique of women's oppression. Feminist thought is based on the concept of the patriarchy, classically defined as a set of social relations between men which establish or create interdependence or solidarity among men that enable them to dominate women. In other words, there is a coalition of interests among all men against all women. Some feminists argue that patriarchy exists alongside or parallel to capitalism, other class societies. Others have subsumed capitalist economic relations within the concept of patriarchy. But all feminist theory comes back to the differences between men and women as the key explanation for women's subordination. The trouble is that this mirrors the sexist justifications for women's oppression. Can 50% of the world overthrow the other 50%? Can we have a revolution against the hormones or the biology or the archetypes that supposedly define our personalities and our destinies? When feminists claim that women are naturally peaceful or non-violent, they are not just giving ground to all the stereotypes that condemn women to home and family, they close their eyes to the role of some women as bosses and government leaders, and they ignore or play down the countless examples of working class women fighting for freedom, in many cases more militantly than men. Because women, like men, are divided along class lines. Ruling class women benefit from the oppression of working class families. Even though wealthy women still suffer oppression, you know, being still a tiny minority in the absolute heights of corporate, judicial and governmental power, there is always a way of softening the blow via nannies, cleaners, gourmet takeaways, resort holidays and so on, where their family and personal needs are like as not taken care of by working class women. And their wealth comes from the backs of working class women and men. One cannot simply be on the side of women. You know, if you are, then why not support Condoleezza Rice, who has helped murder hundreds of thousands of women in Iraq and Afghanistan? Or praise Julia Gillard, who wants to ban women workers from striking? Or celebrate the achievements of Amanda Vanstone, who locked hundreds of women in refugee detention centres? Feminism is a dead end for women who seek to overthrow sexism, because defeating sexism means standing up to a social order. And history has shown us again and again that these struggles, these revolutions, have pitted the men and women of the working class against the men and women of the ruling class. But how does struggle challenge ideas? You know, it is during times of relative social peace and normality that the divisions, you know, racism, nationalism, sexism and so on within the working class seem settled, seem insurmountable. Despite uncertainty and occasional upheavals, we are actually in Australia living through one of these generally stable times. So to some people, it can seem a bit unbelievable that even after a revolution, that some men would really not just sit back and let women clean up after them, or would really stop sniggering at sexist jokes, or that even with the best will in the world, women would not get ignored and interrupted as happens so often now, that we could be free of the crippling lack of self-esteem and self-confidence that makes us stay quiet or blush or stammer or apologise when we actually want to be heard. Sisters, it becomes a lot more believable the more you look into the history of working class struggles, big and small, and participate in struggles yourself. Struggle of any kind involves a rupture in the normal workings of class society. Normally, you know, we might hate how life grinds on, we might feel overwhelmed by our individual difficulties, but no alternative seems to open up to us except to pitter-patter from day to day doing the best we can. But, you know, again and again under capitalism, along comes a challenge that cannot be ignored. They're going to cut our wages by 10%. They want to bring in work choices. They're going to close this childcare centre. They have attacked brothers and sisters in Tibet, in South Africa, in Palestine. We have to respond. Suddenly, the daily routine is suspended without considering what the outcome might be, without in most cases thinking to ourselves, oh, I'm a militant fighter now. People organise with each other to do what's necessary. A few years ago in London's Hackney Borough, A childcare centre was suddenly shut down. The first that parents and workers alike heard about it was on the Friday afternoon. On the Friday afternoon, when kids were being collected, there was going to be no childcare centre on Monday. In shock and outrage, they said, "Oh, no, you don't. We're taking over this childcare centre. It's ours anyway." And they didn't go home. They occupied the centre then and there and started a rowdy, popular community campaign. Now, I don't know for sure, but I don't think any of the parents or workers got up on that Friday morning thinking, I could feel a bit of struggle coming on. They simply responded, and that is the process in mass numbers and small numbers, whereby the normal, crappy, divided and oppressed order of the day can evaporate and people discover in themselves the confidence or the abilities that they never knew they had. The childcare centre campaigners obviously had to work out a lot of issues fairly quickly. Who was going to stay and who come back later to relieve them? What about the kids, dinner and so on? Calls had to be made to partners, to staff on leave, and then of course what about how to defend themselves? How would they deal with the police, the local authorities? Who would talk to the media and what would the message be? What level of picketing or defiance were they prepared to make? Calls had to be made to the union and other unions for solidarity, and in that case the firefighters, a largely male union, were the main support to this struggle, which was initiated and run largely by women. Now, try to imagine the response from these women if someone told a sexist joke or interrupted one of them, these women in the centre when they were speaking. Yeah, I don't think there's... It's the experience of organising and fighting back that breaks down ideological aspects of sexism in a way that education never will. I found a classic contrast in a current issue that I call the Battle of the Tight T-shirts. You may have read about a so-called phenomenon called raunch culture. This is a term coined by New York feminist Ariel Levy in a book called Female Chauvinist Pigs, which claim women who enjoy porn and share sex videos with people like on the internet, who learn pole dancing as an alternative to salsa, who wear T-shirts saying porn star or my boyfriend's girlfriend hates me, you know, who like the Pussycat Dolls, these women are at best deluded, at worst, they are accused of undermining the whole feminist project, of belittling their sisters and becoming agents of women's oppression in their own right. Now, when this position was put to school students via a regular issues page in the education supplement of The Age, the responses of young women and men, like on the website afterwards, were instructive. You know, almost 100%, both the women and the men regarded this position as clearly and simply the older generation doing what they always do, you know, complaining about our sexual mores and what we wear. An underlying message was, what's the problem? Women have to choose how they dress. You know, remember that old slogan, you know, wherever we go, whatever we wear, you know, like no is no and yes is yes, all that sort of stuff. And I'm with them. Our expression of sexuality throughout society, no matter what form it takes, are oppressed by sexism and sexual oppression. And, you know, whoever we are, we can only make use of the, you know, sexual expressions that are available to us under capitalism. So it makes no sense to call women, you know, who are in asserting their sexuality in some way, choosing themselves to dress in whatever way they want, to say that they are the agents, or, you know, they are the pornographers, they are the people that are belittling women. But where young women get strength and power to fight back against this is not in their bedrooms, on their own, or in their relationships. It is crucially through our social power, i.e. as organised workers. And the classic example was Westco in 2004. Sarah Freeman, an assistant store manager at Westco Jeans, refused to wear a provocative T-shirt that Westco insisted that all female employees wear. Low V-neck T-shirt saying, "Stop pretending you don't want me," emblazoned across the front. Not only that, but the T-shirts were issued with a memo that said, "No T-shirt equals no work," i.e. you were going to get the sack if you didn't wear this T-shirt, which, as the Sex Discrimination Commissioner, you know, later, you know, subsequently found, invited harassment. And, you know, it was this woman, you know, who could ring up a union, who could actually stand up in a situation where women have some power to say, you know, it's not my choice to wear this T-shirt and I'm not going to wear it. And that is where women actually, you know, can get some power to fight back against these things. Because class struggle, you know, throws us into new situations. And I think I'm running out of time, so I'll have to, you know, cut through some things. But I don't believe that there is an account of a revolution or upheaval anywhere where the issues that which most deeply affect women are not addressed. That's because there is no revolution or class struggle where women have not been involved. And not only that, but history shows again and again that when women do break their shackles, their energy and determination and militancy almost always surpass that of men at key points in the struggle. For example, in the Paris Commune of 1871, the bravery of women communards, you know, seeking to defend what was in many ways the first workers' state in the world, became legend. When male militias retreated, women's battalions would rush forward to take their place. Nurses picked up weapons from the dying and continued fighting. A woman who was accused of killing two royalist soldiers reeled off the names of family members of hers that had died on the barricades and died herself shouting, "May God punish me for not killing more!" It's not funny. These women, you know, fought so bravely because they were fighting to defend a struggle which had abolished many oppressive laws relating to marriage and religion, which had begun educating girls for the first time, which had been about the first place in the world to pay equal wages to women. You know, from prostitutes forming a union during the Spanish Revolution to Palestinian women's militias in Jordan in 1970 to Tamil Tigers female suicide bomber squads to the tarring and feathering of scabs, which seems to have been a popular pastime for women in mining communities from Broken Hill to South Wales to California, you know, to young women textile workers in the factories of southern China, you know, the Soweto Electricity Crisis Committee we heard about yesterday that's run by grannies, you know, to the women who marched in South Africa, you know, in their miniskirts to defend their right to dress how they please. You know, the realities of working class struggle give the lie again and again to myths of female passivity. But it's not enough simply to look to struggles. I was struck yesterday by some similarities between China and South Africa in the sessions that we heard from Ao and from Zodwa and Trevor. In both countries, there is a massive level of struggle. But both Ao and Trevor said that each struggle tended not to look beyond the horizons of its own immediate demands. Socialists are not required for workers to struggle, but socialists, organised, experienced, hardened, determined, are indispensable if those struggles are going to go forward and win socialism. To push every, you know, we need socialists to be pushing every struggle we're in to link up with others, to argue with and win our fellow workers to a perspective of revolution is possible, socialism is possible, to learn and then teach others the lessons of our history that will guide us in the battles to come. You know, it's not enough just to look to struggles. The women's liberation movement that I started talking about, like the Gay Liberation Front, took its cue from liberation struggles, revolutionary struggles that were rocking the world from Mexico to Europe to Vietnam to the heart of the USA in the late 60s. Women were part of the struggles against war, struggles against racism, but within the movements and within their lives, the reality of oppression, of numbing suburban conformity, of laws which defined women as second-class citizens could be borne no longer. Yeah, we're talking about a time just 30 to 40 years ago where women were required to give up their jobs after they were married, where women weren't allowed to sit on juries, were given drugs and, in extreme cases, electric shock treatment and the like when they suffered depression and anxiety. Divorce could not be obtained without an expensive court case that had to decide whose fault the relationship breakdown was. The right of men to rape their wives was upheld by courts. Abortion was illegal, dangerous, difficult to obtain, and equal pay for equal work was far off in the future. You know, the struggles of those momentous times and since allow us to celebrate how far we've come. You know, there's no turning the clock back on some of those issues. But ultimately, the revolutionary aspect of those struggles was defeated. Despite the massive gains, we find under capitalism that we have to fight, we have to defend the victories we've won again and again and again. And that's why I guess it's so important to talk now, you know, to raise the questions, to debate out the issues about this fundamental question of human liberation, you know, so that we can best work out, you know, how we can clarify ideas and keep on fighting and building, you know, socialist organisation for the struggles to come.